Good. All right, thanks. So, it's strange to be talking at a conference on many-body localization, given that I've never done any work on many-body localization, but I've thought about it a great deal. The conference organizers, I think, wanted me to talk about other insulating phases, hopefully with some connection to this. But what I'm actually going to do mostly in this talk is not talk about theory at all, but talk about experiments. And as far as I know, the behaviors that I'm going to be telling you about reflect the equilibrium properties of systems measured at zero temperature under conditions when they are at least putatively in equilibrium. And then, since I'm interested, I'm going to be focusing on insulating phases, which has to do with the behavior at zero temperature. It has to do with the extrapolation of these measured equilibrium properties to zero temperature. Good. So, last week, Boris Spivak came and, Boris Altshuler came and visited us at Stanford. And gave us a beautiful talk on localization at edges of two-dimensional topological insulators. That's his title. And this was, at core, a technical talk on Kondo spins coupled to a chiral Luttinger liquid, reflecting work done in these two interesting papers. But the subtext of the talk was that topologically protected edge states really don't exist. And so in real solids, for very specific and understandable reasons. So I'm thinking about the converse subtext. Many-body localization is certainly, as we've seen, an extremely profound new development in the field. It's very exciting. The question I'm asking myself, and I'm not going to answer, but it's the background motivation for the choice of topics, is it relevant to the properties of real materials? By real materials, in this case, I mean bulk solids or solid films. One certainly can conceive of device circumstances where it's clearly relevant. Or is it always destroyed by, for instance, phonon-induced variable range hopping? And even if that's the case, are there phenomena that are close enough to being described by many-body localization that this is a productive way to think about them? So that's the subtext. I'm not going to actually talk about this. I did, in preparation for this talk, I've spent a lot of time looking through the literature to find data on insulating phases. And it turns out there's shockingly little data. Most data is, for instance, looking right near metal insulator transitions or superconductor insulator transitions, where the insulating state is sort of wimpy. And so I asked the other Boris, my expert on insulating phases, and he came back and he said, indeed, he thinks that there's really not much that's been done that's systematic on this. And I checked with Elihu yesterday, and he concurred with this statement. And this is probably good news. It means that there may be all sorts of interesting undiscovered phenomena to deal with strongly insulating quantum matter. OK, so let me start with.
So what about experiments that are presented as being about variable range hopping?
There's, you know, when you look up under variable range hopping, you find theory papers with thousands of references. And there are a few papers I'll show you some data on it, but actually even for variable range hopping, the data is much more sparse than you would think. I mean, there's good data for it, but it's not as convincing, it's not as widespread across materials as I thought it was. So, good. So what I want to do is to start with an Anderson insulator, which is a model problem we understand, and ask what happens if we turn on weak interactions. And to begin with, if we turn on weak repulsive interactions, we sort of know what happens. We start with an Anderson insulator with some density of states. There's a Fermi energy here, all the states below here. I have to remind everybody I'm going to be talking about ground states and low energy states here, not typical states. So the ground state has all of the states below the Fermi energy filled by electrons of each direction of spin, and all of them above here empty. And then if we turn on weak repulsive interactions, there's a effective repulsion between two electrons in the same localized level, which is something like some short-range repulsion divided by the localization length, which is finite, because by assumption this is an Anderson insulator. And so all of these states are now going to be singly occupied, which is a big change in the structure of the ground state. It's no longer connected simply to the ground state of the non-interacting problem. In particular, this will generate some density of spins, and then those spins will do some interesting low energy physics, which will in turn lead to something or other, maybe a spin glass, maybe a random singlet phase, which is a distinct phase of matter. And indeed, this is seen in experiment. This is magnetic susceptibility of strongly insulating phosphorus-doped silicon. This is three-dimensional material. Here's the density of donors. And what you can see is that the susceptibility is positive. It's a paramagnetic response. And it diverges not as fast as a Curie law, but it diverges with some power law as the temperature goes to zero. I think Ravin Bhat can probably tell you much more about this than I can, but it's presumably some form of random singlet phase. In a Anderson insulator, by contrast, there would be a paramagnetic but Pauli susceptibility that would be temperature independent, so this is really a distinct phase of matter. If we turn on weak attractive interactions, at first blush that sounds more innocuous. We turn on the effective attractions and, well, still we have all these states doubly occupied. There might be some small amounts of rearrangements at the Fermi energy, but the main thing is that now, if I try to make an excitation of the system, if I take an electron out of one of these states and put it up there, I have to pay the attractive U effective. So there's going to be a gap in the spin excitation spectrum, which is of order this U effective. No, not times the density of states, just of order U effective.
What about superconducting instability?
So these states are strongly localized, so there's no superconducting instability. This remains an insulating phase, just a strongly paired insulating phase. The theory of this was discussed, well, by many people, but they're called Anderson negative U centers. This would be a system then that would have a spin gap, because to make a spin excitation, I have to break a pair, but no charge gap. I can add a pair in one of these states just above the Fermi surface. And okay, this is what's seen in chalcogenide glasses. Here's the magnetic susceptibility of two different chalcogenide glasses. This is temperature here. This is, by the way, 250 Kelvin. This is a broad range of temperatures. And what you see first place is it's negative. It's diamagnetic, not paramagnetic anymore. And it's very strongly temperature independent. And indeed, these systems are strongly insulating. In fact, their conductivities are approximately activated with big activation energies. There's a large gap in the optical spectrum. As I've just said, they're diamagnetic. And on the other hand, if you try to gate them to move the Fermi energy, you find that the Fermi energy is strongly pinned. There's lots of states at the Fermi energy. These states are highly compressible. So if you want, these are the nicest example that exists of pairing without superconductivity. There's pairing on the EV scale, but these are among the best insulators.
What is the reason of such a strong pairing? What is the macroscopic region?
In loose sense, it's electron-phonon coupling that's responsible for it. You know, when people delved into it more, it's chemistry. It's something to do with the nature of dangling bonds in chalcogenide glasses. These are very local. I mean, it's chemistry. It's not physics that gives this negative U. So, because it is on very big, it's on EV scales. Good. In the presence of spin, if we turn on either weak electron-electron attraction or weak electron-electron repulsion, we end up with something that looks qualitatively different from an Anderson insulator, and probably this just derives from the twofold Cramer's degeneracy. This would certainly be lifted if we turned on a Zeeman field. We would get much closer to the sorts of problems that I think many of you have considered. Good. So now I boasted that all of these measurements were concerned the properties of system in equilibrium. And again, in the context of this conference, that requires some justification. One needs to understand something about what are the processes by which the system manages to equilibrate. And so presumably, this is due to phonon-assisted variable range hopping. And so I spent some time trying to get good examples of this. Variable range hopping is an exponential process. So in order to have convincing data, you would really like to have data over many decades of resistivity. And I actually had a reasonably hard time finding much of it. I'm showing you some of it. Here's data from neutron transmuted gallium arsenide. So this is, again, a 2- to 3-dimensional system, which they dope by irradiating it with neutrons, which then do some nuclear reaction and turn some of the elements into other elements, thereby homogeneously doping the material. And so you can see here, you've got a nice fit to variable range hopping. This is so-called Efros-Schlafsky variable range hopping. Along this axis is the temperature to the -1/2 power. So the temperature is going down in this direction. T to the -1/2 is going up. Here you can see that on this sample, for instance, they follow it over 3 decades of resistivity. This funny symbol here, MM, stands for Mott minimum metallic conductivity, which is probably a wrong concept, but this is something on the order of a quantum of resistivity. So these are deep in an insulating phase, so that's pretty good data. Variable range hopping gives a prediction for the temperature dependence of the resistivity. I mentioned activated behavior. Activated behavior corresponds to alpha equals 1. There are 2 versions of variable range hopping. There's Mott variable range hopping, in which electron-electron Coulomb interactions are more or less neglected. So in 3 dimensions, this would correspond to an exponent of 1/4. And there's Efros-Schlafsky variable range hopping, which takes the long-range Coulomb interaction seriously, which gives a dimension independent 1/2. Yes?
It's not very
This is high temperatures. So first place, this is high temperatures, and second place, I'm talking about insulating states, so I want you to look at the most resistive samples. Here's another three-dimensional material. This is doped indium phosphorus, I guess. Actually, the point of this, so here's the log of the conductivity now. That's why these are negative exponents in inverse ohm centimeters. And this is temperature to the minus 1/4, and this is temperature to the minus 1/2. And the most important point in this paper is that they've established that it's Mott and not Efroshlovsky, presumably because this line goes through the data better. You know, okay. I mean, this is a big difference. This is on a logarithmic plot. On the other hand, the theory is an asymptotic theory, so I'm not sure one wants to be all that convinced that they've established this. But at any rate, it's doing some form of variable range hopping. We really do more or less, in some loose sense, understand how the system equilibrates here.
Yeah. No, I just want to say that my experience with all those fittings that you can get the fit to this one yeah. properly very good.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to fit this to an activated behavior, but distinguishing between Efroshlovsky or Mott, I think, is extremely difficult under most circumstances. Here's a very different example. This is a two-dimensional material to start with, and it's not a doped semiconductor at all, but it's a film of a material, indium oxide, which is superconducting in zero magnetic field. This is an extremely disordered sample of indium oxide. It's actually very hard to get metals to be insulators. You have to really beat the crap out of them. A lot of the experiments on films are on indium oxide, which for some reason admits to having the crap beat out of it better than most metals. And the reason we know this is particularly dirty is that the critical value of the magnetic field at which the superconducting phase is destroyed and at which a superconductor to insulator transition is quite low, about half a Tesla. Some of you may have heard a talk by Aaron Kapitolnik last week. I'll show some of his data. He's looking at what he calls highly disordered indium oxide films, but they have critical fields of 3 Tesla. So they're substantially less disordered than this film. And what you can see is at high fields, far from the superconducting state, that this actually gives quite a beautiful fit to Efroshlovsky variable range hopping over, in this case, maybe seven decades of resistivity, which I think may be a world record. good. So I would claim that at least in some places in these disordered insulators, the relaxation process occurs more or less as we expect it to. Now, there is a feature of the insulating state, and somewhat unexpected quantum feature of the insulating state that I think has become increasingly clear, but for which there really isn't a good theoretical explanation, which is that in two dimensions in a magnetic field, the insulating state is something that we christened a Hall insulator. And here is the characteristic of it. If you measure the conductivity tensor, of course, it's an insulator. So the conductivity must go to zero as the temperature goes to zero. That's sort of a defining feature of an insulator. But if you measure the inverse tensor, the resistivity tensor, that while the longitudinal resistivity diverges, the Hall resistivity appears to approach a temperature-independent asymptotic value that's comparable to its classical value of B over NEC, despite the fact that you're strongly in an insulating phase. Just so that you understand that this is algebraically possible, if I invert the conductivity tensor to calculate the whole resistivity, it's this, okay? We all know how to invert 2x2 matrices. And if, as the temperature goes to zero, if sigma xy goes to zero, like the square of sigma xx squared, then this ratio approaches a constant. A phenomenological argument for the existence of Hall insulators in the neighborhood of a quantum Hall to insulator transition was presented by Donghai Li and Sucheng Zhang and me some years ago. This is a set of arguments. It's certainly not a theory. There was an attempt to do a real theory of this by these authors who tried to calculate the Hall resistivity in the variable range hopping regime. And they got complicated results, which depended on exactly how they did the averaging. But at the end of the day, they concluded that they couldn't get a Hall resistivity, a Hall insulator behavior, that they always found that rho xy diverged, albeit much more slowly. But this occurs all over the place. So here's the first place I've seen it. This is high mobility gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructures from the Sui group. This is probably Vladimir Goldman's thesis, I'm not sure. The purpose of this study was actually to look for very high lying quantum Hall plateaus. They discovered that there's a 1/7 plateau here. This is the longitudinal resistance, and there's a tiny little feature there. Here's the Hall resistance. And so, of course, there are plateaus here. Here's the 1/5 plateau really starting to be formed, which was actually quite astonishing in this data at the time. People forget now that they see, you know, denominators in the thousands, but you know, this was quite amazing. But the thing I want you to focus on, so the other thing is that measuring rho xy accurately when rho xx is very big is very difficult because you can get contaminated by misalignment of the leads. You can improve the situation by symmetrizing the data. The Hall resistance is odd under magnetic field goes to minus magnetic field, whereas the longitudinal resistance is even. So here was the Hall resistance measured with the field up, and here with it down, and here they've averaged it. And this straight line is just B over NEC. And so what you can see is here, we're really quite deep in the insulating phase. The resistivity, well, okay, 20 is not quite the quantum of resistance. The von Klitzing's constant is 25 kiloohms, and this distance is 20 kiloohms, but they're sort of the same. So you can see that the resistance is getting much bigger than the quantum of resistance, and here this curve has been divided by 8, so it's really way up there. So this is a very, very insulating sample, and yet the Hall resistance is more or less classical. Here is an experiment that Hongwen Zhang did of the sort that I think we should all encourage people to do. He purposely sought out to find the lowest mobility gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructure he could find. He made it as dirty as possible so that he could see an insulator. Usually, you can't see an insulator in these systems at zero field, not because of anything fundamental, just because you would have to go to temperatures of order h bar over the life of the universe in order to get into the localized regime, because they're so clean. So here was a really dirty sample. Here's the longitudinal resistance. Here's the temperature dependence of the longitudinal resistance. The line through the data is a fit to variable range hopping. I don't actually remember whether it's Efroshlovsky or Mott, but it probably doesn't matter. And here's the Hall resistance at 300 millikelvin and at 4 millikelvin. And again, you see it's showing no tendency to diverge. Here's on another material. This is a silicon MOSFET by Kravchenko and his collaborators. Here's temperature to the minus one on this axis, and the log of the resistivity here. Here's the longitudinal resistance. These dots are the hole resistance. This dashed line is the classical value. It's not the quantum of resistance. The quantum of resistance is a little bit below that. But again, one sees that we're deep in an insulating phase, but the hole resistance is its classical value, roughly. I think one understands this a little bit better if one thinks about it from the point of view of the phase transition from the quantum Hall effect to the insulating phase. I think every talk in this conference has to refer to collaboration with Shivaji Sandhi. Here he appears in his postdoctoral days. So here you see on this straight line, this is the Hall resistance as a function of magnetic field, and the dashed lines are the longitudinal resistance at two different temperatures, also as a function of magnetic field. There's a very well-defined crossing point at which we go from the quantum Hall regime, in which the resistance is vanishing, to the insulating regime, in which the resistance is diverging. And what happens is that rho xy is continuous across this transition. Rho xy at zero temperature must be exactly one up to the transition, because that's the definition of a quantum Hall state. And then what you see is that it's sort of, you know, maybe it has a slight upturn as it goes out into the insulating phase, but it's a continuous function as we go across here. This is sort of the experimental version of Tarun Grover's continuity argument, maybe. I mentioned work that Aaron Kapitolnik talked about last week. This is experiments on dirty, but not quite as dirty, indium oxide films near the superconductor to insulator transition. So here's the resistivity as a function of magnetic field at different temperatures. The red is the lowest temperature, the brown is the highest temperature. You can see that there's a crossing point on this side. The resistivity is decreasing as you decrease the temperature, so that's the superconducting phase. On this side, the resistivity is increasing as you decrease the temperature. That's the insulating phase. What you can see is that in this insulating phase between the critical field for the superconductor to insulator transition and the field at which this peak in the resistivity in the magnetoresistance occurs, that the Hall resistance is essentially temperature independent. It's got some smooth value. This value here, by the way, is more or less B over NEC. So it rises over this range from zero to its classical value. Then beyond the peak, it does something else. It's got some temperature dependence. It is certainly growing as you go down in temperature. So here.
Why rho xy is not linear at h going to zero?
So it's zero for a range. This is the superconducting state. So it's zero for fields below this field. And then it rises. So like within the quantum Hall effect, the Hall resistance appears to be continuous across the superconductor to insulator transition. It's zero in the superconducting state, and then it rises as you go into the insulating phase. So what do you mean by HC2? I mean, the only phase transition we have here is the transition between the superconducting state and the resistive state. There, the if you were to estimate, you know, a pairing field, a mean field HC2, it's probably somewhere up here. So all of this is somehow in a regime where local superconductivity of some sort, don't push me to define that too sharply, but local pairing of some sort is probably significant across here. Probably these materials are granular to some extent, so you can probably think at least loosely that what's happening is you're spoiling phase coherence between the grains, but you still have pairing on the grains. I wanted to say one other thing. I mean, this is what data always looks like in these superconductor to insulator transitions. You know, you have to say that neither the superconducting state nor the insulating state are quite as superconducting or as insulating as you would like them to be. I mean, the resistance is definitely decreasing here, but it's not decreasing so rapidly that any idiot would look at it and say, clearly that resistance is going to be zero at zero temperature. And similarly here, it's doing a little bit better. The resistivity is certainly rising as you lower the temperature. But here, over a range where the temperature changes by a factor of 3.5, the resistivity changes by a factor of 2. That's not like the variable range hopping we've seen. That's not a strong insulating phase where sort of presumably just getting into the range of temperatures where superconductivity and insulating behavior are asserting themselves. But at any rate, in this region, the Hall resistance is more or less temperature independent. And here, if you use some way or other to extrapolate to zero temperature, you get this blue curve for the Hall resistance as a function of field. So it's zero, as I said, in the superconducting state. And then it rises linearly with field as you move away from the superconductor to insulator transition. With ideas of duality in mind, we tried to invert the resistivity tensor to extract the conductivity tensor. You can see the result is very noisy, but it sort of looks like it's the dual of the Hall resistance, that the conductivity is zero in the Hall insulating phase and then rises linearly as you go into the superconducting phase, as if this is a vortex insulating phase that mimics the charge insulating phase over here.
Just understand, at H smaller than HC, this is a transport of vortices, H smaller than HC.
So,
a finite rho xx, is it due to the fact that the vortices unpaired and unpinned?
Presumably it's due to vortex motion, but you know, here's the data. You know, I
understand, but what is your view?
Yeah, so presumably what's happening is that there are some vortices that are unpinned, and as we go to lower and lower temperature in this regime, they will ultimately get pinned, whereas on this side of the transition, the vortices are actually delocalized in the sense that even at zero temperature, the vortices will be itinerant. Okay, I mean, that's the story. This is the data. You know, these are really disordered samples. They're probably inhomogeneous. I mean, I suppose you could make a Bardeen-Stevens estimate, but I wouldn't trust it at these temperatures and these small vortex sizes. Yeah.
What stops the experimentalists from going to
full temperature?
Yeah. So. What? Yeah, so I can tell you in this case exactly what stopped them. Their cryostat broke. There is a new cryostat. There's a new generation of experiments coming online. Now, that being said, as I said, it's hard to measure rho xy. So there's no doubt they can go to lower temperature and measure more strongly insulating behavior and more strongly superconducting behavior, assuming that it does what we expect it to. It's not obvious they're going to be able to follow the Hall resistance down to much lower temperature. Aaron actually has some extremely clever ways of using, you know, modern technology to measure, for instance, sigma xy directly. And so some of these things may also be circumvented in the not too distant future. But okay, the answer to your immediate question is sort of stupid, but there it is. The other answer to the question is that Aaron's grant proposal on this subject was turned down. So I'm taking names. good. So far, everything we've looked at is at least consistent with the idea that we can do measurements even in the insulating phases. We can stay in equilibrium if we work hard, and we can get rational extrapolations to zero temperature. So the question is, do we see any evidence anywhere in the experimental literature for something different? Evidence of either a finite temperature transition to a insulating phase, or something that looks something like an almost transition to an insulating phase. And I'll show you some data on this. But then there's a second question is, if we see that, how do we know, given that it's not just a question of money, but we really don't know how to measure things like the growth of entanglement in the laboratory. How can we distinguish many-body localization from classical glassy states? So first, let me show you what I think is extraordinarily exciting data. And this was, for me, worth the price of admission of having to prepare this talk, as it finally motivated me to read this paper. So this is actually the same indium oxide film that I showed you for variable range hopping. This red curve is that variable range hopping result. And the blue curve is the result at a lower field, much closer to the superconductor to insulator transition. And here it's plotted just the way it was before versus t to the minus 1/2, which worked beautifully for the high field data. But close to the superconductor insulator transition at not too low temperature, of course, the system's much, much more conducting because you're close to the superconductor to insulator transition. So you're only a little bit in the superconducting phase. In the insulating phase. But then as you lower the temperature, this resistivity really takes off much more rapidly even than variable range hopping. This is, I think, an experimental tour de force. These sorts of numbers are numbers I've never seen on resistivity curves. They've, you know, it's really hard to measure this big of resistivities. So here's the same data plotted versus temperature. And what you see is that this, you know, that, I mean, this is a logarithmic scale. And even on a logarithmic scale, this data just falls off a cliff. It really looks like it's heading to a finite temperature phase transition at which the resistivity would diverge. And indeed, this dashed line is a fit to this function. So we're at temperatures T bigger than T star, but you can see that the exponent here would diverge if the temperature approached T star from above. So here are the numbers. This T naught is, I don't know, 0.138 Kelvin. T star is about 0.03 Kelvin. The closest they can get to before they stop being able to measure it is about 30% above T star. So when I say that the resistivity diverges, we're extrapolating 30% in temperature. And again, just to orient you, the quantum of conductance, well, the superconducting quantum of conductance here, probably we don't want to negotiate about factors of four, but this is what's usually used when talking about superconducting materials, is somewhere up at the top of this curve. And so all of these are orders of magnitude smaller than the quantum of conductance. Okay, good. So that's impressive. Now, let me now raise the question about how to distinguish this from a classical phenomenon. And so that form reminds me of a form that's used to study the properties of supercooled liquids as they approach the glass transition. So this is a problem that has no quenched disorder in it. It's a problem that presumably has frustration. and in which here is the viscosity of orthoterphenyl as an example of a good supercooled liquid. Here's one over temperature here, and this is the log of the viscosity. The viscosity is more or less a relaxation rate, so you can think about this as being the relaxation rate. And now you see that this viscosity over a limited range of temperature rises by 16 orders of magnitude. I think that's the biggest dynamical range of anything in solid state physics. Well, I guess you could take the exponential of any property you measure, and that's bigger. But I'm going to tell you what some of these symbols on it mean. This is from an article that has no original work in it, but that if I interest you in this topic, this is an article. First place, I'm proud of the fact that it was published in Nature Materials. That makes me feel like I must be a, you know, really hands-on person. It describes what some of the totally unsolved issues are in the theory of supercooled liquids. So on this scale, the one temperature that really clearly has a sharp experimental definition is this. That's called the glass transition. That's when the relaxation rate equals the lifetime of a graduate student. Nobody believes that there's any fundamental importance to this. We should just make our graduate students work longer. But this is where you stop being able to do experiments slowly enough and the system falls out of equilibrium. This T naught is if you fit this data to the so-called Vogel-Fulcher-Tamman law with some putative extrapolated temperature at which it would diverge, this temperature T naught is the extrapolated temperature at which the viscosity would diverge. And as in the other data, so first place, this is exactly the same functional form. And as in the other data, you never get all that close to it. In this case, you can get to about 20% above T naught. TK is another extrapolated temperature. It's called the Kaussmann temperature. It's where some extrapolated thermodynamic quantity goes haywire. There are other things here which I won't bother to talk about. T star will show up in a minute. So that's the other temperature that I'll mention. Okay, I already said that. So this looks like the data. And the important point here is not that the physics is going to be the same in the two systems. It clearly isn't. But this is a purely classical problem which has extraordinarily compelling evidence that looks like there's an extrapolated temperature, let's call it an ideal glass transition temperature, at which the viscosity would diverge if we could stay in equilibrium. Now, that's not the only way to parse this data. Another thing you might think of is thinking of plotting it as a temperature-dependent activation energy. And so here, what I've done is plotted the viscosity. Here's O-terphenyl. That's the same as this data. But these are other supercooled liquids. And what you see is that at high temperature, there's a temperature-independent activation energy. That, by the way, is something that there's no theory of. Nobody understands why in liquids whose structure you can understand beautifully by studying a system of hard spheres, why there's an activation energy and what that activation energy means. But there is empirically. And then there seems to be a very well-defined temperature at which that activation energy starts to grow. So you might organize this data by saying that something to do with ordinary fluids occurs above this temperature T star, and then there's some onset of collectivity of some sort at a characteristic temperature T star. And for reasons that I certainly won't discuss and am not prepared to defend, we proposed a form for this activation energy that was a constant above T star and then turned on with some weird power law below T star. The only point about including this is that this gives a perfectly, in fact, it gives an extremely good fit to the data. And this is a functional form that has no phase transitions in it.
So
it has three adjustable parameters over the whole range of temperatures.
It's got a singularity. It seems like phase transition.
Right. So it's got a weak, that's correct. But it's so weak that you don't see that. I mean, we don't expect that there really is. That's just the simplest thing not to have data. And you're right. You can see that right here, we have a singularity in the fit, and there isn't in the data. Okay, but what my point is that this doesn't have a singularity at T naught. There's no ideal glass transition. It is possible to fit this data very convincingly with a form that is certainly structured, but that doesn't imply a finite temperature phase transition. So what does this have to do with the data that I showed you? Well, two things. The first is that it tells us that one could imagine finding very strong temperature dependence of something that looked like it was undergoing some sort of finite temperature insulating transition in a purely classical system. And the second thing is that, so of course, seeing that in an electronic system by itself is exciting and fascinating. But the question one would like to ask is there a way in the electronic system of unambiguously distinguishing an apparent classical glass transition from an almost many body localization transition? Okay, and with that, I'll end. Thanks. And I want credit. I did what the organizers told me to. I ended with lots of time for discussion.
Isn't it true that the classical phase transition is followed by the singularity in thermodynamic properties, rather than the many-body localization transition, which doesn't have any singularity in thermodynamics?
Correct, but now, so two things. One is, it's not obvious for the glass transition. So there are theories of the glass transition that argue that it's classical, but a purely dynamical transition with no thermodynamic singularities. But the big problem here, so I agree with you that if you could really stay in equilibrium to the transition and through it, that you could then at least distinguish whether there was a thermodynamic signature here at the transition, and that would be, you know, so if the specific heat was completely featureless through the transition, then I think one could begin to at least narrow down the options. The problem is that you tend to fall out of equilibrium not at the transition, but well above the transition. And so it's not obvious to me that you're going to be able to answer that question practically.
Steve, it's very interesting to make this analogy, but in the glass transition problem.
I should say, I'm not making an analogy. There's too much difference between the two systems. It's a functional analogy, okay. Not a physics analogy.
Okay. So you made a functional analogy. So I'm just asking, since you've reviewed the literature now, of course, in the glass transition, it's marked very much by hysteretic phenomena also. And then these electron problems, you know, when you say falling out of equilibrium in this spectacular data where you have these 12 decades of resistance. Did those guys look for hysteresis in the charge response?
So I spent about an hour with Dan Shahar on Skype last night, and they've been looking for it. They've been looking for slow dynamics in this problem. They haven't yet seen anything that they're prepared to go public on or to.
You're telling me it's not a memory stick.
What? What's a memory? What do you mean by? No, I mean they're so their claim is that this resistivity that they're plotting, this, is really the resistivity. It's time independent. It's linear response. They've gone to as low. I mean, that, so earlier on this film, they did see all sorts of nonlinear and hysteretic things. And in getting this data, they've gone to heroic measures to do things at extremely low current density and, you know. Okay, so of course, they're looking for dynamics. For instance, as you said, glasses have all sorts of characteristic dynamical signatures as well. But as far as I know, they don't have anything to report.
If I'm not mistaken, these are the same films where they saw presumable decoupling between electrons and phonons. A few people here, I think, had some theories of that. Maybe they can elucidate. Is this phenomena seen here too, or could it be related to what they're seeing?
So these are the same films. They've gone to a regime where they don't see those, but those experiments already give us reason to believe that the electron-phonon coupling is extremely ineffective in these problems. So these are good places to look for decoupling. Yeah.
So isn't indium oxide also the compound where they see all these aging? This is to comment on Gabe's question. So Zvi over there, who sort of usually talks about these memory effects where you shift the gate and it takes 10 years for the chemical potential to adjust. I mean, is this the kind of aging phenomena that you want? Just change the carrier.
Either of you.
You know, I don't know anything about, I don't know much about glasses, but what is the aging, what sort of aging effects and the hysteretic effects that one should try to induce here? Can you be more specific? Changing gate potential and watching the carrier density?
So, you know, assuming that they're right that above this temperature where they're measuring the resistivity, then they shouldn't see any aging. They should see the same answer here, okay? I mean, that's what it means. You know, below the glass transition, of course, everything is going to be hysteretic and out of equilibrium, both in structural glasses and here. But I think the question is, in the regime where they're measuring this resistivity, where they're seeing this tendency to diverge, anyway, I don't know. Aaron, in his much less disordered films, does not report any such thing.
Is it possible to see to measure thermal conductivity at any of these? Because the statement is that there exists no classical transitions, even in glassy systems, where thermal conductivity has some, I don't know, goes to zero or something. But in the MBL, we know that it goes to zero. But now there are phonons here. Is there some way to look at some part which is a singular part which?
You know, the problem is that all of these are films on a substrate, and so thermal conductivity is going to probably be dominated by the substrate. And you could probably measure things like thermopower. I don't know if that's good enough for you. I mean, it hasn't been done, but I think that in principle can be done. I think thermal conductivity is going to be hard, but okay, I'm not an experimentalist. I'm...
In your functional comparison to glasses, do you refer to fragile or to strong glass formers?
Yeah, so what I was showing, operationally, fragile glasses are glasses where the activation energy is strongly temperature dependent, and strong glasses are ones where they're not. Okay, I've showed both here, germanium oxide. You can see that the activation energy is constant down to the glass transition temperature. this is probably not very interesting. So the functional form, I mean, it doesn't tell us anything functionally. This either means it's a different animal, or that because the bear activation energy is so big, you never get into this region where you see the upturn. So what I'm comparing to is functional forms that are used for fragile liquids. Now, there is a development along those lines, which is recently people have managed to make supercooled metallic liquids, and you see very similar temperature dependence of the viscosity. There's a huge hole in the data here, and it's for some technical reason that I've never understood, but the data is much less compelling than the line through it. But
thanks. This might be a bit of a stupid question, but in the theory of variable range hopping, what would that tell you for the Hall resistivity?
Right. So, I mean, Hall resistance in the hopping regime is complicated, but there is this. Whoops. Now, what have I done? Okay. There is this paper by Imrie and collaborators where they attempted to calculate it, and they found that it did not. So simple variable range hopping, Mott variable range hopping, was not capable of giving a non-divergent Hall resistance. The Hall resistance diverges much, much more slowly than the longitudinal resistance, but it still diverges. There is a theory. It's one of my least favorite papers, and I'm a co-author on it, but it is possible to prove that if you have localized states and if you define the limit in the wrong way, that is to say, if you look at zero temperature, measure the conductivity as a function of frequency, invert it, and take the zero frequency limit, that you get generically a non-zero Hall resistance, even though the longitudinal resistance diverges. Okay, it's the physically wrong order of limits. The physics is all wrong, but it's a correct calculation in that wrong limit.
Well, if there is any more, no more questions, then it sounds like there's, there is one more question. Okay.
In this formula for OXY, what exactly is N?
Right. So it depends which problem we're talking about. In the quantum Hall systems, we know what N is because you look for, say, the center of the nu equals 1 plateau. Now, it's not exactly B over NEC, but it's, well, you saw in that SUI data, that straight line was really beautifully B over NEC. In the superconducting samples, the operational way you determine N is you go to very high fields, much above the mean field HC2. There you see what looks like some normal dirty metal behavior at this range of temperatures, and in particular you see that the Hall resistance in that regime is temperature independent and linear in B. And so you take the slope of the Hall resistance at, say, 30 Tesla, and from that you infer what N is. The spectrum doesn't have to be parabolic to get, one of the reasons people look at the Hall number is that it's remarkably insensitive to details. Now, the spectrum, these are very disordered. The band structure is totally irrelevant, and the mass doesn't come in, it's only N. Anyway, operationally, N is defined, when I say this is of order B over NEC, N is defined from the high field magnetoresistance, Hall resistance.
At what temperature?
It doesn't matter, it's temperature independent.
No, You see, the rank correction correction to the whole effect, to the whole effect, which has the same logarithm here.
They don't see logarithmic behavior here. They see, in fact, if anything, the longitudinal resistance decreases as you decrease the temperature, but very weakly. But the Hall resistance, operationally in the range of temperatures, so it's the same range of temperatures, it's down to 0.2 Kelvin, is temperature independent. So this isn't supposed to be rocket science, but it's a well-defined operational definition of what N is.
I think it's a good time to wrap up our discussion, and let's thank the speaker.